Yes. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's my pleasure and privilege this evening to introduce Fred Halliday to give the first of two lectures on the Middle East. In fact, it's a pleasure and privilege, but it's also quite difficult. I think introducing Fred to an LSE audience is a bit like introducing Nelson's column to Trafalgar Square. It's not really something that one would do lightly. I thought about how to do this, and I decided to take my cue from Ian McEwan's new novel, Saturday, which I thoroughly recommend. I think McEwan is our greatest living novelist, not that that's got anything to do with anything, probably the greatest novelist in English now that Saul Bellow's dead. His novel, Saturday, has a protagonist called Henry Perrone, who is very worried about what's going on in the Middle East and terrorism and so on and so forth. And fairly early on in the book, he in the kind of interior monologue that McEwan's letting us in, he drops Fred Halliday's name. He says he's read Fred Halliday's book on the Middle East. And he doesn't sort of explain this. He doesn't say Fred Halliday, fellow of the British Academy, professor of international relations at LSE for the last 20 years, Montague Burton Chair of International Relations, leading specialist on the Middle East, 12 books. He just kind of assumes that the sort of literate, intelligent people who buy his novels and who turn up on these occasions know perfectly well who Fred Halliday is. He genuinely needs no introduction. So I'm not going to give him one. I'll just say that I'll say, Fred, please talk to us this evening on the Middle East in the modern world, states, conflicts and ideas.
Thanks, Chris, for those very kind words. As those of you who know me know, one of my endlessly repeated themes is the theme of universalism, that we can apply certain analytic categories to different countries of state and nation and society, even, dare I mention, the obscene word class occasionally, but also that moral values also have significant universal terrain. But there are times when even my universalism is dented, and sometimes it happens that LSE, I remember in the days of the Cold War, in the space of a very short time, I received a visit from an American professor and a Soviet professor. And I'm afraid I couldn't but see the differences of culture, because each of them had two questions. The American said, Halliday, how much are they paying you? And secondly, can you choose your own graduate students, or do you have to leave that to the dummies in administration? Well, I said, we don't have dummies in administration, but I have limits on the graduate students I can choose. And the Soviet professor came. He was a veteran of the siege of Leningrad. He was unhealthy. He spoke eight languages. He could quote Pushkin at great length and very charming. He said, Professor Halliday, for you, I have two questions. How many days a week do you have to come into the office? And secondly, are the books on the shelf yours, or do they come with the job? And you can't deny the importance of culture. More recently, I was in Yemen, which is a country very close to my heart, on which I did my PhD, and which I've written two other books. And I was in the coastal town of Bayt al-Faqih with a driver who was a member of the Presidential Guard, and indeed told me with great relish that he'd shot lots of my socialist friends during the last civil war. But we got on all right. And it was my birthday. And he discovered my birthday, and he went off, and he did what he thought was the appropriate thing. He bought me a large bunch of flowers. And then he stood in front of me and he said, Professor, he said, you look great. You look 100 years old. And I thought, Chris Brown is right. Chris Brown is right. There are incompatible and incommensurable cultural discourses in the world. I mean, this was my immediate response. I've resiled a bit from that, Chris, since then. But I can assure you on that grand moment, being told I looked 100 years old, you are very much in my thoughts. I'd like to thank the LSE for the occasion to give these lectures, which are, in the immediate sense, occasioned by two books of mine, which have come out more or less at the same time, and are in many ways the same book, if I can put it this way. One is an academic book, The Middle East and International Relations, published by Cambridge, which is a textbook, mainly for postgraduates, and which is based on the experience of teaching, with great benefit to me, I hope to some others, the international relations of the Middle East here with Philip Windsor, and more recently with Caterina Della Cura, over the past 20 years and more. And it is very much an LSE book. It's an LSE book in tone, I hope, It's an LSE book in the respect for history. And above all, it's an LSE and International Relations Department book because it is an attempt to combine a set of theoretical explorations and a range of analytic theory concepts and indeed normative concepts as well with the study of a particular region and to meet what I call the double challenge. The double challenge being to apply the theory to the region in a way that explains and doesn't just obscure as much theory has done, but secondly, to test the theory against the region, because if the theory cannot explain why these states go to war, or why these states suppress their peoples, or why ideology has the role it has, or why oil has the effects it does, and so forth, if the region breaks the theory or cannot be seen to demonstrate the relevance of theory, then there's something wrong with the theory. The theory can't fly. So the double challenge is that of applying the theory to the empirical study, in this case a mere 24 countries, but conversely that of seeing how far the theory itself flies or works. But in the course of writing this book I felt an enormous problem, and in fact it stopped me writing for 2 years, something that never happened to me before. It didn't in the end do me any harm, because I realized there was another book I wanted to write, which was a book from the heart about the role of myth and ideology and falsehood and half-truth in discourse about the Middle East. As I always say, this comes from both sides, from the West and from the region. And I wanted to do it in a different way, so without conceding too much, I've written what I think is my first and probably last postmodern book. This is a book you can open at any page and read in any order you want. I mean, there is, of course, a grand narrative, don't get me wrong. There is a... but it's not immediately evident. And in it, I've listed 100 common ideas about the Middle East, which I think require critique or reassessment, and on which, in the light of other evidence or other texts, can be shown to be faulty. My Arab friends often say to me, why only 100? There's 1,000. And my Persian friends say, why only 1,000? There's 10,000. But I hope that it's a book which will do what the critique of myth is supposed to do, not just to correct error, it is to make people freer, to some degree to emancipate them from the claims of religion or of tradition or of history or of falsehood or whatever it may be. And if it serves that purpose, which is the underlying, as it were, Hegelian purpose of the critique of myth, then I hope the book will have served its purpose. But I've also done something else at the back, which I'd be very interested to know whether people think it works. I've done a glossary of several hundred terms or place names or ideas which have been thrown up by September the 11th and its aftermath. In other words, places or ideas, some of which were there before, but which acquired new meaning or new force, the word rendition, for example, or prisoner abuse, or the word jihad, or the particular use by bin Laden of the concept of Andalusia, which is not with historical precedent, and many other things, including a nice Australian phrase, doddering daiquiri diplomats, which was a phrase used of some people who criticized Prime Minister Howard's policy. And in some way it reflects my interest in language, which is an ongoing concern of mine, and also with the ways in which language and politics intersect, a theme which, of course, many people wrote about well in the 20th century, including George Orwell. But I realized that it had another purpose, and it's a purpose which was articulated in this part of London exactly 250 years ago by one of the greatest of all British English writers, who, had he lived in another age, would certainly have been an honorary fellow of this school and have a lecture hall named after him, namely Dr. Samuel Johnson. His great dictionary was published in April 250 years ago. And in the introduction to this book, Johnson says something which I think is of immense importance for all of us. He says, you might think that the person who compiles a dictionary, a list of words, which is what I've done here, would have to be a calm and contemplative person. But we all know that Johnson was far from being. He was an extremely bad-tempered, choleric, difficult person. And he also made the point that language itself is forever changing. He didn't obviously have the concept of a photograph, but what he was trying to say was you have to catch the moment and write that down. That's the least you can do, in the full knowledge that the next moment it will have changed. So he didn't write the dictionary in the sense of an academy freezing meaning. He wrote his dictionary in the attempt to capture the sound and the meaning at a particular time, and at least to do that in order to cope with the chaos that was within all of us and also the chaos which was in the world. And I think this quite psychologically profound comment on the nature of dictionaries and of compiling glossaries is one that should apply to this case, because I think September the 11th has been a profoundly disturbing event for all of us as citizens, as parents, as teachers, as people who worry about the future, as people who take airplane journeys and so forth. I don't think any of us know where all this is going to lead. And I think, and I would also hope that while the first part of the book, the myths part, is the most intellectually important, I'd hope that this attempt to capture, even fleetingly, some of the vocabulary and the amazing richness of vocabulary thrown up in the Middle East and in the West by the crisis will help to, in some way, to stem the sense of unease which these events and March the 11th, which followed in Spain, and other things which I fear are going to follow, will cause in all of us. These books are LSE books in several senses. First of all, as I say, in the attempt to meet this double challenge of theory and region, one which is shared by other colleagues, and it's interesting to see that James Mayle and Christopher Clapham and many colleagues in our department have been working on Africa in the same vein, Peter Calvert on Latin America, Michael Yehuda on East Asia. This attempt to sustain and develop the international relations of regions, now more recently Roy Allison and Edmund Herzig on Central Asia, or Inner Asia as they prefer to call it, is a very strong part of the broader British international relations and area studies traditions, and I think a very good one. And I've certainly learned a lot from seeing how people tackled Latin America, or tackled Africa, or tackled East Asia, or Eastern Europe. But it's an LSE... with the LSE products in another way, which is we have here something which I think we undervalue. We have a cosmopolitan community of people drawn from well over 100 countries, well over half the countries in the world, probably three quarters of the countries in the world at any one time. And we have a space, a very precious space, for debate and discussion and of tolerance. And this is something which we know is not universal. Censorship is on the rise in many countries, not least in the Middle East, where books that were allowed to be published 10 years ago, including books by me, are now banned in most, if not all, Arab countries. Tolerance of debate on historical questions is threatened in many countries. And I myself believe that if we have something to contribute in terms of an ethos, it must be this cosmopolitan tolerance, which is something that is not automatic, something that can be destroyed. I'm living in Barcelona, teaching and researching in Barcelona at the moment. I'm very struck by how nearly all the cosmopolitan cities in the Mediterranean have been destroyed in the last 100 years, nearly all of them, by nationalism and by Cold War, and of course the most recent one being Sarajevo. And there are very few left. And I think there are such cosmopolitan spaces, and the intellectual and moral richness it brings is something that we need to value. And in teaching the Middle East, I've been very, very struck by it. I remember in 1991, during the Kuwait War, when, as you recall, Iraq was launching missiles against Israel and Saudi Arabia, I had a visit from a student, an Arab student whose parents lived and family lived in Saudi Arabia. But he came to see me to say, look, my family are under the missiles, nobody knows what's going to happen, I feel I have to take leave of LSE to go back to be with my family. And 3 days later, an Israeli student came to see me and said exactly the same thing. They both went back to be with their families to face the uncertainty of the missiles, which in the end didn't do that much destruction. But none of us knew that then. I remember in the mid-90s bringing to LSE a group of Israeli hawks from the University of Bar-Ilan. And they came and they laid down the line and they had a very lively discussion with the students. And afterwards, a Saudi student came to see me and said, thank you for bringing them here. He said, because nowhere else in the world, except LSE, could I meet and hear such people. He said, and I need to meet and hear such people. And I think that's something which we should value as well. Sometimes the interest in the Middle East of students can go a bit awry. I remember once having a visit from a student around this time who was looking for career advice. And he came in and he said, Professor Halid, I hear you know something about the Middle East. I said, yeah, I know something. He said, look, I'm thinking of going to the arms trade. Do you think you can give me any tips? I said, no. On another occasion, I remember somebody put on to me by the consultancy branch of LSE came to see me, an Arab businessman, and he laid out a map of his country. And he said, Professor, he said, we are ruled by thieves and tyrants. I said, yes, indeed you are. He said, I founded a National Liberation Front to fight the oppressor president. He said, can you advise me, he said, where to start an armed insurrection in my country? He said, you British, you know it much better than we do. And I realized he was pushing his briefcase towards me. He was taping it. So I said, look, you know, the wisdom of your people is 1,000 times greater than that of the British colonialists and so on. Well, his brother had been a PhD student of mine, so I called him up, and he said, oh, Ahmed isn't up to his old tricks again. I said, what happened? He said, well, he was trying to get the contract to renew the refurbished London embassy, but the president gave it to his brother instead, and that's why he turned against him. So I said, who's in his front? He said, no one. I said, not even his driver? He said, not even his driver. I said, well, that was good. On another occasion, I remember in the Middle East lectures, there are students who take the course and who are in the classes, and there are others who, we don't have auditing in these countries, but who came to, who listen and who regularly attend. And I noticed there was a woman from the Middle East who not very formal Muslim clothing, but she wore a hijab and she was sat at the back. I didn't take notes, but I noticed that she laughed at the jokes. I thought, I wonder who this person is. And late in June, as people were dispersing, there was a knock on my door and in came this woman. And she was a princess from one of the Gulf states. She said her children had grown up. Her husband had encouraged her to come here. She said, I have escaped from being a princess for a year at LSE, and that's been a wonderful thing. And we talked about her country, which I knew well, and where they had killed and tortured some of my friends, not she, but other members of her family. And we had a very fascinating discussion, and she also very much appreciated her time at LSE. And I think that we must defend this, and I have to say that I am absolutely opposed to all calls and claims for boycotts of any universities or any countries in the Middle East. I have lectured in over half the countries in the Middle East. I've lectured in the Baghdad of Saddam Hussein. I've lectured in the Tripoli of Colonel Gaddafi. I've lectured in the Tel Aviv of Benjamin Netanyahu. I've just been lecturing in Khartoum in Sudan. And I think it is our job to talk, to engage, to listen, and to disagree. The one word, a bit abused in recent British politics, but a word that I have come to think more and more of is the word respect. Respect means you listen, you study the history of these countries, you study their languages, you study their culture, and once you do that, you can disagree. Just as with a research student, if you say to them, I think the chapter's great, let's go and have a coffee, that's not respect, that's an insult. You read the chapter, you say what you agree with, you say what you disagree with, and then maybe you go and have a coffee. And I think one has to engage with these countries. There are people there who want to engage. And I think it is against the general principles of academic freedom and open-mindedness, but particularly against the traditions of this LSE, for us to get involved in such campaigns. We are not a solidarity committee. We are a social science university with a commitment to tolerance and openness, and we should sustain that as long as we can. And the other side of this, which I think needs to be emphasized, is that throughout the Middle East, there are people from the LSE playing an important role. I was recently in Sudan with five LSE people, courtesy of a former PhD student. The political officer at the American Embassy has a PhD from the Anthropology Department. The former Minister of Social Affairs, the great-granddaughter of the Mahdi of Khartoum, has an MSc from the Economic History Department. The head of the World Bank mission there has an MSc in economics from the LSE. Several people at the university have studied here. There is an LSE nucleus in Sudan and in many other countries. I know the history of Afghanistan reasonably well. The number two in the UN mission in Kabul is Dr. Inouye, who did his PhD, a Japanese, very distinguished Japanese diplomat, some of whose family are here tonight, and I bid them welcome, who did a PhD on naval power in the 1970s in the International History Department. The only member of the 200-strong UN mission in Afghanistan who speaks fluent Pashtun is a student at this school currently on leave, and his job is to talk to Pashtun tribes, in other words, to talk to people who are close to, if not closer to, the Taliban, and he does so under clear instructions. And there are other LSE people there as well. And I think that we should realize just what an impact and just what a role this school has had in that region, not specifically by training people in area studies, but by training them in broader issues in the social science. I, at the same time, believe that the study of the Middle East in LSE and in departments of international relations should be a cause both of celebration and of alarm. Celebration because, as you will see from the handout I've given, there is now not just one or two people, but a cumulative body of work by people versed in international relations theory and in international history on the Middle East, some from this school, some from other universities, which can, I think, without exaggeration, be called a British School of International Relations of the Middle East. Louise Fawcett in Oxford has just edited a major book on this subject. Anoush Ehtishami in Durham and Ray Hinnibush in St. Andrews have produced a volume of work. There are several other books. Gerd Nonnemann in Lancaster has also just produced an edited volume. We have produced, through debate, through mutual support, a very substantial and varied and theoretically sophisticated body of literature, which is without parallel anywhere in the world, including the countries which are supposed to be our international mentors. And I think this is something that should be noted and celebrated, as well as the quite wide range of people from LSE who have over the years written on the Middle East without our having a specifically Middle East department. But I think there is also cause for concern, and for three reasons. First of all, the level of public debate on the Middle East in the politics, in the press, in the public opinion of the West has degenerated in a very dramatic way in recent years, has become much more prone to exaggeration, to forms of racism and simplification and alarmism. And I have to say, somebody of my age who was formed in the 60s and 70s marked by a very significant degree of recidivism, of going backwards. We are having debates now which I would have thought we had left well behind. Are the Palestinians a nation? Are the Israelis a nation? Is each of them entitled to their own state? Do we really have to go back over this debate again? Is Islam as a cultural category capable of explaining social and economic and political behavior? There were great books written on this 20 or 30 years ago showing that it is not an explanatory category at all, and yet now we've got all these books on Islam explaining this, that, and the other. We've recently been treated to debate, some of which may be positive and sincere, about reform in the Middle East. But the Middle East I've known for 40 years, and it is 40 years, has been full of people carrying out reform, some of them quite radical. The Yemen I lived in, there was radical land reform, they were settling nomads, they were calling for the alliance of the workers, peasants, and fishermen, and they were the only revolution in the world actually to have as an official slogan, "We must arm the women," which indeed they did, with various consequences. And so the idea that reform is something that is alien to the Middle East, which is a current platitude, is historically quite inaccurate. But there is a degeneration and worry, secondly, in terms of some of the debates that in both public policy and academic life seem to have acquired legitimacy, if not a dominant position. Pride of place among these must go to the claim that there is something called a clash of civilizations, without which no newspaper article or television discussion seems to be these days sustainable. I will come to this again in the second lecture, but I would only say that neither historically nor in contemporary terms does this hold up, certainly not in international relations, certainly not in analyzing the politics of countries, and that it is a travesty of the kinds of conflicts, the kind of alliances, the kind of problems, and the kind of interrelationships which have marked both international relations and domestic politics in recent years. And it's also a very dangerous and irresponsible one. The debate on terrorism has been greatly simplified, I think partly as a result of a refusal to see the historical sources of current Islamic terrorism, which lie, if I may say so, in the Cold War. They don't lie in Islam or the Arab mind. They lie in Afghanistan in the 1980s and in the campaigns by a number of other countries wishing to isolate socialists and communists, be it in Yemen or be it in the West Bank or be it in Turkey or Algeria or elsewhere, to encourage fundamentalist groups at that time. And yet very little of this seeps into the public domain. But there is a third concern for alarm, which is about our own theoretical and conceptual apparatus. I think that September the 11th and what's followed from it, and also these public simplifications like the Clash of Civilizations or like essentialist and religious explanations of terrorism, are easier to sustain because we are ourselves unsure of our own methodological and theoretical position. I mentioned three things very quickly, which I think September the 11th has highlighted, our own underpreparedness. I think we have, for half a century, in large measure, failed to focus on the issue of violence as a social phenomenon in itself. We focus on crime, we focus on war, we focus on dysfunctional this, dysfunctional that. But violence as a social phenomenon, with its psychological, social, military, and other consequences, and also the ethical dimensions of, we have largely ignored. And indeed, if you ask who has written well on this, you have to go back to Eric Fromm in the 1930s and 40s to find some of classic points of reference. And yet violence is a phenomenon in its own right. It requires interdisciplinary study. It is like a drug. Once it starts, it's very hard to let go of. And as we see in the country from which I originally come, and which is the template of many of my own political and moral judgments, not all of them, but many of them in Ireland, once a political organization goes down the path of violence, it does not lose the habits which that experience has bred in it, much as it puts on a pretty face and parades itself as the equivalent of Irish motherhood and apple pie. I will say no more at the moment, but those of you from that part of the world will know what I mean. I think, secondly, that curious as it is, despite the fact that we study religion and we study politics and political theory, very little of good sense has been written in international relations on the role of ideas in international relations. In fact, there's been a prejudice against talking about ideas in favor of other things, be it power politics on behalf of the realists, be it economic interests on behalf of the Marxists, be it perceptions on behalf of the constructivists, liberals, or whatever it may be. The role of ideas has been downplayed, if not denied. And yet, stepping back and looking at the world in the last 200 years, look at the spread of ideas of nationalism. Look at the spread of ideas of social revolution. Look at the spread of ideas of modernity. Look at the spread of ideas now of religious fundamentalism. We are disarmed, because of this neglect, from understanding the phenomena that we encounter. But thirdly, and related to both of these, we are disarmed because we have neglected the issue of culture and international relations. Again, it was seen as a product, as a residuum, not as anything that had autonomy in its own. And because of that, those who now come and say that culture is the explanatory factor and explain everything have the field to themselves. The reason why Huntington's grotesque argument has got as far as it's done is because those who would oppose it are not sure of what to say, either in historical terms or in analytic terms. For example, it's very easy, and it sounds wonderfully smart, to say that Europe has defined itself against Islam. Sounds great. But now, wait a minute. First of all, what is Europe? What is the role of Islam in the formation of British or German or French national identity? I don't see much role for Islam in all of this. It's more defined against each other. The Battle of Waterloo is rather more important than the Battle of Lepanto, as are internal factors like the Industrial Revolution and internal migration. But we've left the field open to the simplifiers because of the neglect of this question. But there is something else that concerns me, and I'm not saying anything original, but I'll say it with some force in this context of area studies and international relations. The drift of social sciences today is towards abstraction, towards methodology, towards generalization, and the depreciation of history, the depreciation of language, the depreciation of area studies, of specificity, and indeed of knowing anything about anything. It sounds wonderful. It is driven by the totally unwarranted, intellectually unwarranted hegemony of economics in its current banal form over the social sciences as a whole, hegemony it does not deserve, and which is anyway in violence of some of the better traditions of economics. Heaven knows what Ricardo or Adam Smith or Marx would make if they came back from the dead to see what's taught as economics today. And we are finding ourselves driven by the hegemony of these abstract and, in my view, largely, not wholly, but largely vacuous methodologies in dominant institutions in the United States and elsewhere, away from that which is necessary for understanding the contemporary world and the regions involved, and also a depreciation, and I'm speaking in a very old-fashioned way here, of the disciplines and the time necessary to get on top of studying these areas. And the result of this is, and this here I come back to the public domain, that faced with what is the dominant strategic and political and cultural challenge of the 21st century for us, namely the confrontation and relations with the Muslim and the Arab world, we have remarkably few people anywhere in the Western world who are competent to assess and talk upon these questions. If you compare the effort put into training experts on Russian history, on Soviet ideology, on Russian language in the Cold War, the situation which we are now faced, and a much more complex situation it is given the lack of clear lines, we are seriously and culpably disarmed. And this leads to the fact that the field is open to the simplifiers and the charlatans. The number of books you read which explain the current relation with the Muslim world or with the Arab world in terms of culture and centuries-long conflicts and the rest of it, putting Saddam Hussein together with Saladin and Arafat and heaven knows what, and the Turkish Empire, are legion, and the number of measured, informed studies are very few. And here we come back to the challenge. I think that in a social science university of this kind, we have a duty and we have an opportunity to train people to think in a more sophisticated way about these questions. We have to reassert the importance of history, of language, of specificity, and indeed fall back on the old but very important word which some of our mentors applied, and it's remarkable how often it recurs, judgment. It's about judgment, it's not about data. It's not about methodology, it's not about algebra, it's not about incredibly complex new theories, it's about judgment of history, of trends, and of social science categories. And it seems to me that that is an intellectual challenge which the LSE is singularly able to make, but it's got to meet it, and not capitulate to the vacuity which masquerades as social science in so much of the world today. In that vein, I'd like to turn to some specific issues in international relations pertaining to the Middle East, which I think demonstrate how one can begin to grapple with the double challenge that I mentioned. If one asks the question, what is the role of analytic or explanatory theory in international relations, I'd say roughly three things. First of all, to explain the behavior of states, who were and are the central actors, not the sole actors, in international relations, and we've got about 200 of them at the moment. Probably not many more to go for the time being. Secondly, to explain the power and actions of what we clumsily call non-state actors, for want of a better word, but companies, social movements, religious groups, NGOs, whatever it may be, those things which are not states. And thirdly, to assess the importance in constraining states and non-state actors of global structures. Now, of course, if you're a realist, the global structure is military power and the security system. If you're a Marxist, it's the world economic system. If you're a transnationalist or a liberal, it may be international law. But I think all share the view that the actors in international relations, be they states or non-state actors, are constrained by the system of which they're a part. And here I always quote the words of another one of our distinguished alumni, the late Canadian Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau, once asked, what margin of freedom does Canada have in international relations? He thought for a minute and he said, well, he said about 5%. Maybe a bit more than that for some or for others, but I think it was a salutary observation. Let me, however, begin with a broad question, which is this. When the international relations of the Middle East were taught 20 or 30 years ago, they were largely taught as the study of the great powers in the Middle East, in the colonial epoch and then in the Cold War. So that what happened in the region, the Arab-Israeli wars, the foreign policy of Iran, the rise of Saudi Arabia, the oil policy, whatever it was, were seen as a result of the role of the great powers and their influence. And this, of course, one can continue into the post-Cold War world with the study of globalization, which is another global structure and one which many people in the region feel is very influential. But the balance of reflection has shifted quite dramatically in recent years, and I think one thing very interesting for all the differences between the different people in Britain writing about the IR of the Middle East, one common thread is the greater emphasis on the autonomy and room for maneuver of regional states and actors. In other words, there is a global context. There are powers who you have to respect or to whom you have to appeal, but the regional states have a much greater degree of autonomy than might at first appear. Let's start with the Arab-Israeli question. The Arab-Israeli question in its origins in the 40s had nothing to do with the Cold War. Truman and Stalin both recognized Israel and both supported the establishment of the State of Israel. Later on, the United States supported the Arabs against Israel in the Suez Crisis of 1956. Later on, in the 70s, the Arab-Israeli conflict came to coincide with the divisions of the Cold War, but at that point, the Egyptians chucked the Russians out, so it didn't really have much relevance to what later followed. We now know from documents released in the Soviet Union and also from documents which Israel captured in Lebanon when its forces were there, that the PLO took almost no notice of what the Russians said to them about the need to recognize Israel and the need to moderate their military activities and so forth. If we look at the outbreaks of major wars in the Middle East, the Egyptian attack on Israel in 1973, or the Israeli attack on Egypt in 1967, the great powers had virtually nothing to do with it. Of course, they calculated that if they acted, their stronger allies would support them. But in no sense were they ordered to do so, or did they clear this with the great powers before they did so. When Saddam invaded Iran in 1980, or Kuwait in 1990, he didn't consult anyone. Of course, his enemies said he was acting at the behest of the Americans, or that he was going to Tel Aviv every week to get his instructions, but I don't think the evidence supports these claims. Even the country that I studied in my PhD, which did me the great disservice of disappearing 2 months after my book was published in 1990, there was a conspiracy there somewhere, but I've never quite found out what it was. South Yemen, which was an impoverished country of 2 million people, they carried out a civil war in North Yemen. They sent arms and support to guerrillas in the neighboring state of Oman. They denounced the feudalists and reactionaries of Saudi Arabia against the advice of the Russians, who were their main supporters. And I think this autonomy is not just a recent thing. If we take what is perhaps the most important foreign policy decision taken in the modern history of the Middle East, and the one which had the greatest consequences, which was the Turkish-Ottoman decision to enter the First World War on the side of Germany in 1914, there was nothing structurally determined or preordained or indeed externally determined by this. The Turks were secretly negotiating with both sides, with the Russians on the one hand and with the Germans on the other. It could have gone either way, or they could have remained neutral, as they did in the Second World War. And a series of chance events, the British impounded two ships, which they'd been building for the Turks, the Russians refused to meet the Turks halfway on their demands, and a factional fight within the Turkish leadership led to them finally joining the war in October 1914. But there's very little global structural in this outcome. I myself am also interested in something else, which is the role of subregions. The Middle East, there is North Africa, there is what's known as Sham or Mashrek, the eastern part of the Arab world, and then there is the area of my own particular interest, the Arabian Peninsula. And spending time in Yemen and visiting, now I've now visited all the countries in the Arabian Peninsula, you're struck by the fact that the international relations of the Arabian Peninsula has its own autonomy. The main concern for the smaller states in the Arabian Peninsula is how to live with Saudi Arabia. With an expansionist Wahhabism in the first part of the 20th century, and then with a now unstable and increasingly fundamentalist public opinion in Saudi Arabia itself. And if I have one factional pursuit and campaign in the study of the Middle East, one sectarianism, it is to try and get greater attention paid to the international relations of the Arabian Peninsula. And this has many consequences, but the one I want to mention here is this, because it's a matter of enormous and usually uninformed public concern. It's an enormous amount of debate here and in the States, the Middle East, about is the Palestine question the Middle Eastern problem? Is it the source of all the conflicts and state formation in the Middle East? Now, this is a subject of public controversy, because, of course, the Israelis say nothing to do with us. and the Arab nationalists say it's all the fault of Israel and Zionism. Well, this is a good example of a question which can and should be taken out of the domain of public polemic and subject to calm academic debate. Is the history of state formation, of revolt, of nationalism in the Arab world over the past 50-odd years a result, wholly in part, of the Palestine question? And the answer, in my view, based on studying specific countries, is on some occasions the Palestine-Israel question played a role, and in others it didn't, but at no time was it the dominant or sole factor. So it's a middle-of-the-road but empirical answer. I can go on for hours about the development of nationalism in Yemen, or in Saudi Arabia, or in Oman. Palestine was a factor, no doubt about that. But to say that it was the dominant or sole factor is quite misleading. But although it may be that it's become more important in the last 2 or 3 years with the Second Intifada, with Jazeera Television and all the rest of it than ever before, but that's an open question to which I don't know the answer. But clearly the Middle East is not one conflict. In all the Arab-Israeli wars put together, 100,000, including Lebanon, perhaps 100,000 people have lost their lives since 1948. In Sudan, where I've just been, 2 million people have just lost their lives in the war, which has just come to an end. In the Algerian war, the civil war that has just ended, 150,000 people have lost their lives. In the Iran-Iraq war of 1980 to 88, probably 1 million people lost their lives, and so on and so forth. In the Lebanon war, they say 150,000 lost their lives. How these things are calculated is another matter, and we shouldn't be fooled by over-precise quantification. But clearly, there have been a number of wars which have interrelated but have also been clearly distinct. So I think the first thing we can help to adjudicate and to separate out a bit is this issue of the global, the regional, and the sub-regional. Second issue, which has come very much to the fore in recent years, is the question of the relationship between states and social movements. Now, I make no apology for saying that I began life writing about social movements and radical movements, and the first book I wrote was a book about guerrilla war and revolutions and nationalist movements in the Arabian Peninsula. But I have to say that by the end of the 70s, after the book was published, our old friends the state, and indeed great powers, reasserted their authority, and the social movements were contained. Yet, in more recent years, and in writing these books, I began to think maybe it's not all that simple. After a look at the role in the Middle East of the Iranian Revolution of 1978 to 79, and the enormous upheaval this caused, look at the role in Lebanon of Hezbollah, look at the rise of bin Laden and al-Qaeda. Look at the importance of a whole series of revolutions, Egypt 52, Iraq 58, in the modern history of the Middle East. Maybe, after all, but without undue progressivist teleology or anything like that, maybe, after all, the history of the Middle East has to be written more in terms of social movements, ideas, than in terms of the power of states. And, of course, sitting in the Middle East now, whether you're in the American or British embassy or in the palace of the president or the king, you're going to be asking yourself every day, there's a social movement out there called Al-Qaeda and its friends. How powerful are they? What staying power have they got? Are they going to overthrow us? And in most cases, you just don't know. So I think we have to bring social movements back. At the same time, I think they shouldn't be overstated. There's a tendency in international relations literature in general, and in some of the literature on what's now called global civil society, to overstate the autonomy of social groups and NGOs. For example, Jazeera Television. Now, I've been on Jazeera Television, and there are a lot of things you can't say on Jazeera Television. There are red lines laid down by the state which funds it. You can't criticize Islam, you can't criticize the ruling family, you can't discuss corruption, you can't discuss the spending practices of princes or princesses. You can't discuss the treatment of women, you can't discuss the treatment of migrant workers. I mean, I could go down the list. Al Jazeera is not an autonomous expression of an independent media. It is the arm of a state. It just happens to be a different kind of arm than the traditional arm of people reading out communiques and boring speeches for an hour. But it's the same. It's the arm of a state. It's not autonomous in any way. And basically, it's a way of sticking it to the Saudis. That's what it is. It's a way of annoying the Saudis on the part of Qatar, which is a lot of money. But there are a lot of things. I was even on once with Abu Qatada, who's bin Laden's representative here, recently detained by Her Majesty's pleasure. I'm glad to say all things let out again. And we had a huge ding-dong about the destruction of the Buddhist temples in Afghanistan. But he He completely took me by surprise. He said, there is an international Buddhist conspiracy against Islam, he said. Muammar al-Dawliya Japaniya, good Islam. He said, look, UNESCO is denouncing us, run by Japanese. These Japanese tourists coming to Afghanistan, pretending to look at the statues, are bringing in arms to the Shiites and the communists. So he went on, fantastic, but it was theater. So I think we shouldn't overstate Al Jazeera. Then people talk a lot about NGOs in the Middle East. In some countries there are NGOs, but an awful lot of them are run either by members of the ruling families or by the secret police, and we ought to face this fact, or are controlled in such ways. So I think we oughtn't to overstate these things. But there's another area of society I wanted to mention, which you can't live long in the Middle East, which is people's attitudes to power. People in the Middle East are very skeptical about power. They know their rulers are thieves. I remember going to one of the Gulf states, and I was going to some festival organized by the army, and my host was a colonel. He picked me up at the airport. We hadn't got out of the airport, but he said, Professor, there's one thing I want you to know, he said. All our rulers are thieves. And my first thought was, where's cultural relativism in this? You could be in China, you could be in Peru, you could be anywhere in Mozambique, and you'd know exactly what he was saying. But secondly, he didn't need to be told by George Bush or by anybody else about the nature of his rulers. And another obvious factor of this is, where do people invest their money? The Arab world is not short of capital, but people invest it here because they don't trust their rulers. But the other area where this is expressed, which I think is very fascinating, is in the area of humor. You can't be long in the Middle East without hearing people making fun of their rulers. There's a story of one of the Arab presidents had given a long speech, and he called his advisors. He said, I want you to write short speeches for me from now on. So next time he gets up and he speaks for 2 hours. And afterwards he says, I told you to write me short speeches. They said, yes, Mr. President, but you didn't have to read all 5 copies. And this attitude of contempt is very... In the Sudan, where we were recently, there's a nice story. Sudan has been ruled by fundamentalists since 1989, but it doesn't look like a fundamentalist country. Half of the people, the women in the streets, don't have any head covering. And by the side of the road, there are women selling in little glasses and cups what's called tea. But lots of things have the color of tea, including whiskey and wine. So they're selling alcohol and everything, and they always have them. So the governor of Khartoum, who was a fundamentalist, decided he was going to put a stop to this. So he went in disguise, and he went down, and he asked the woman for one of these things, and he took it. And then he said, this is haram, this is against Islam, you mustn't do this. And she told him to get lost. And he said, do you realize who I am? I am the governor of Khartoum. And she said, yes. She said, I'll give you another glass of this, and you'll tell me you're President Omar al-Bashir. And this is very profound. I remember once being in Saudi Arabia, and I met a member of the Consultative Council, the main political body, nominated body, the Majlis al-Shura. And we were drinking whiskey, and he got talking. And he told me the story of a man who was arrested leaving Saudi Arabia on a donkey with a bag full of money and a woman on the donkey with him. Nobody knew what to do. So finally they took it to the king. They said, what are we going to do? And the king said, well, price of oil might go down. Put the money in the treasury. The woman, well, maybe she'd like to marry my brother. He hasn't got a wife at the moment. He's a nice guy. Ask her, maybe she'd like to marry him. Then he'll look after. He's wealthy. The man let him go. And they said, what about the donkey? He said, the donkey, I nominate him to be a member of the Consultative Council. He said. And this told by a member of the Consultative Council. And these perceptions, I think it's very important, the idea that people there don't know about the nature of their rulers or that society is cowed in some totalitarian way is a great mistake. Third thing I wanted to mention is ideology, both nationalism and secular ideologies and also religion. There is a tendency in studying the Middle East to take at face value what people claim about these ideologies. That, for example, Islam says this about the economics, or Islam says that about the state, or Islam says this about the position of women. The whole point about these ideologies, these political applications of religion, is that they are choices. They're choices by those in power to select those bits of the tradition which they want. If you want to justify capitalism in Islamic terms, there's no problem in doing it. If you want to justify socialism, the same. If you want to justify the return of slavery, there's plenty in the Quran about slavery, you can justify the return of slavery, and some people do. But the point, it's the ideology cannot be the explanation, because the ideology, the religious traditions and the law and the text give you limitless variance options as to what you actually want to promote. And it's very interesting, if you look at the ideologies of states in the Middle East, all of whom are supposedly Islamic, all of them, with the single exception of Saudi Arabia, make happy and extensive use of the pre-Islamic past, which they're supposed to denounce. In Egypt, it's the pharaohs. In Iraq, it was Hammurabi and Nebuchadnezzar. In Iran, it's Cyrus and Persepolis and all this. In Yemen, it's the Queen of Sheba, and so forth. In Tunisia and in Libya and in Lebanon, it's the Phoenicians, although they interpret the Phoenicians in different ways, but for all of them, they're all descended from Hannibal and Amilcar and so forth. So what should, on religious grounds, be prohibited, the legitimating use of the pre-Islamic past, is universally carried out, and quite happily so, because that's what modern states and societies do. It's nothing to do with religion. And therefore, the ideology is formed by the interests of state and by whatever bits and pieces of the past they want to use. It's not a function of the ideology itself. But this also applies to the oppositions. It's very easy to look at Khomeini, Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran, who was the leader from 79 to his death in 89, or more recently Bin Laden, and say these are expressions of the Islamic psyche and of Islamic tradition, and of course this is what they'd have you believe. But actually Mr. Khomeini and Mr. Bin Laden are modern politicians. What do they want to do? They want to take control of states and hang on and fight their way to power and shoot the people who want them to be out of power. It's nothing very religious or fanciful about this. That's what they want to do. And the ideologies they generate are a function of those goals, of mobilizing people, of delegitimizing their enemies as Zionists and crusaders and corrupt and children of the devil, or to use the great Islamic term, children of the people of the ditch. It's one of the Khomeini's. These are people of the ditch, he used to say. They do this by a sort of collection of whatever themes are most appropriate for them. But to make sense of Bin Laden's ideology, which is well worth reading in detail, or of Khomeini's, you have to understand the modern context in which they are located. I mean, Khomeini went very far down the line in stealing the clothes of modern radicalism. He talked about imperialism, or he called it world arrogance, istikbar-e jahani in Persian. Actually, rather a fine phrase in some cases, but he talked about the need for economic development and getting the monopolies off our back and all that, and bringing water and sanitation to the villages, all the things that modern people do. He even celebrated May Day, 1st of May, is the day of the Islamic worker, and he had a quote from the Prophet. No disrespect to the Prophet. If the Prophet said all the things he's supposed to have said, he must have been talking 10 times longer than Fidel Castro, because he's an awful lot ascribed to him. But some of his, I'm very fond of some of the hadith ascribed to the Prophet, but one of them Khomeini came up with was, the sweat of the worker means more in the eyes of God than the prayers of the faithful. Now that was not part of the Islamic tradition that most people know, and it was functional to his goals. And in the end, Khomeini did what every revolutionary leader of the 20th century has done. He abandoned his internationalist goals, he turned to nationalism, he used a phrase about Iran, in melate bozorge Iran, he said, this great nation of Iran, which is of course exactly the phrase used after 10 years in the French Revolution, la grande nation, the same phrase recurred, and I don't think it recurred because he'd been studying the French Revolution, I think it recurred for functional reasons, because he was trying to mobilize people. And on the other hand, in the months before he died, as if on cue, he produced a theory of state interest, of raison d'etat, based on Islamic reasoning, but he said the key concept has to be maslahat, to be what is in the interest of the state and the people, and everything else, foreign policy. He said if you have to knock down a shrine, you knock down a shrine. If you have to build a motorway, you build a motorway, he said very clearly. And he was constrained by and ultimately produced an ideology appropriate to the modern world. Fourth area I want to mention briefly is what in international relations is termed foreign policy analysis. This is an area in which the school and the department have made a major, major contribution. Recent major study by Chris Hill, who sadly has left us, and by other colleagues, of how foreign policy is actually made. Not the fiction that it's made by rational actors with full knowledge who are trying to maximize state interests, but the real mess and confusion of pushing and pulling and perceptions and short time and inadequate information and the rest of it, the role of public opinion, the role of bureaucracies, the role of transnational factors, the role, dare I say it, in obscenity for many years, but I think a little bit on the way back, the role of personality and individuals. And obviously, in a democratic country with proper bureaucratic procedures, you have the evidence and the documents for studying this. But these questions apply to Middle Eastern countries just as much as anywhere else. I am of the opinion that Saddam Hussein only invaded Kuwait in 1990 because he knew that most Iraqis, even those who disliked him on other grounds, supported him in punishing what they regarded as the feudalist and corrupt Kuwaitis. Not a just view, in my view, but the view of most Iraqis. I think one of the main reasons why Syria has been unable, under father or son Assad, to make a serious diplomatic engagement with Israel is because most people in Syria, from all that I hear, do not want to make concessions to Israel unless Israel unconditionally abandons the Golan Heights, where they've been since 1967, with a small interruption in 1973. And so public opinion does matter. And I think we don't know much about factional bureaucratic factors in these countries, but when we do, we can see. I mean, to take two examples, who killed President Hariri of Lebanon? Well, it does seem as if it was, in some sense, the Syrians. But what the Syrians? Because there is no the Syrians. There's the president, there's the old guard, there's the new guard, of course, with the sons of the old guard. There are all sorts of different factors. Somebody in Syria decided to kill him. But did President Assad know? The gut feeling of most people who know Syria is no, he didn't know. And indeed, many other people didn't know. But some faction within this fragmented state carried out this action. But you can't talk of the state as a unitary entity. We know from the history of Israeli foreign policy and Israeli defense policy that pushing and pulling and factions and secret groups have carried out all sorts of operations which have not always had universal support. If you go back to the Iranian Revolution, it's amazing how initiatives were taken by individual ayatollahs to send arms into Iraq or groups of students to occupy the American embassy, which had no broader support or legitimation, even if the state later had to support them. So this huge area of questions of foreign policy analysis, the role of bureaucracies, of factions, of individuals, of opinion, is very relevant to the study of the Middle East. Final question I'd ask, which is one that intrigues me more and more, but is very hard to answer, is the relationship of politics to economics, and in particular of the state to the non-state sector of the economy. Because in many ways, there isn't a non-state sector of the economy in many of these countries. If in an oil-producing state, most employment comes from the state, if most credit, even to the so-called private sector, is at zero interest based on personal connections to the state, if there is no income tax, then what is a private sector? It's very hard to see one. Even in Israel, where there clearly is a private sector, the state has a major economic role. Two banks dominate the financial sector, both of which have very close connections with the state. Israel is a partly liberalized economy, but the state has a huge role, and where the dividing line falls is very, very difficult to say. I had a sad experience recently. I took one of our new PhD students who wanted to work on the economy of an Arab state to a reception here in London, and it happened to be there was the richest man in the country, the guy who owned the main hotels, and he was bankrolling the president. I thought, this is fantastic. She's going to meet the richest man in the country, this millionaire, very sharp guy. I knew him. He'd been a revolutionary in his youth and so on, and he knew who I was. So I introduced them, and she said, and she spoke very good Arabic, I want to study the economy of your country. And he said, young lady, in my country there is no economy. And, which was true in the sense in which we understand it. He said, there isn't an economy in my country. There's the state, and they're the friends of the state. That's khalas, that's it. It was disappointing for her, and she's had to find another PhD topic, which she's done. But it was a very, very interesting answer. Where does this leave us? I feel a need for those of us who work in this field to be more demanding, more exigent, more impatient of where the subject is going and of the highways and byways in which we've been led by public debate, by feckless methodological and epistemological meta-discussions which belong appropriately in philosophy departments but not in international relations or area studies departments, and to get back to the job. And the job is to analyze the way these societies operate in the contemporary epoch, to relate what we know of them to broader comparative and theoretical concerns, and to produce substantive analysis of these societies. That is our job. And in so doing, if people wish to listen, which recent evidence suggests many of them don't, to enrich, correct, rebuke, and otherwise contribute to public debate and public policy. I do think that issues of theory and epistemology are important, and I think people should be literate in them, but I do not think they should dominate the study of international relations or the study of areas as they have done. And may I, those of you familiar with IR will know what's happened the last 20 years and more. The study of international relations has been beset by a debate on Orientalism, which, much as I respect Edward Said, in other ways I think was largely a waste of time and contributed very little to our job. I've written on this for those of you who dissent. He certainly dissented, didn't speak to me after I wrote this, but I'm stick to my guns. I think we have to defend and promote the study of history, both to understand where the present comes from, but also to correct the misuse of history and the simplifications of history, which are so common in the public debate. And this little book on myths is part of that. I think there is no way round, and we should celebrate rather than be negligent and mean about, the need to have competence in language and to know about these countries. You don't train a surgeon in 2 years, you don't train a linguist in 2 years either, and we should face up to that. I think we should try and detribalize some of the debates about the Palestine question or the promises made in the First World War or the relations between Sunnis and Shias or whatever, which are capable of relatively sensible academic discussion and don't have to become footballs of public debate as they have largely become. And I think we have to reassert the hegemony of social sciences as a whole over the study of the region. A very good example is we don't concede to nonsense about culture or the practices and values of 1,000 years ago explaining the present, as many people seem to think we should. We should realize where these states and societies come from and not subject them to the simplifications of current public debate. We should stick to our guns, and we should celebrate, as I've tried to do tonight, the fact that in this country and in the universities of this country over the last 10 to 15 years, a very substantial and rich body of work has been produced, unequaled anywhere in the world. But as with all academic and intellectual work, the biggest test is the research agenda for the future, which that lays down. And that's not my job, that's yours. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Fred. We've got maybe a quarter of an hour for questions. I think, first of all, we'll let people who have to go, go. But then let's take questions in groups of two or three, something like that, and two groups of three, maybe. While people are leaving, questions? Comments?
Can you hear me? Yes. I want to ask the...
don't think it's on.
It's on. I want to ask about the conflict between Israel and Palestine, because Israel is point of un-Muslimic country among...
Can you speak more clearly? Yeah.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. It's about Israel and Palestine, about the conflict between Israel and Palestine. Can you hear me? Yes, okay. Israel is the only un-Muslim country among a lot of countries that... you know, lead on the Muslim. I think one of the reasons they are Muslim is to control their population. But anyway, do you think there is any change to peace between Israel and the Arab country? Because it's not only conflict between about land, it's conflict about religious. And if Israel have any other choice besides using power or force to exist.
Thanks very much. Let's add another couple of questions. At the top there, yep. No, behind you. Sorry.
Yeah, what is the role of religion in the making of politics in the Middle East?
It's a big one. Yeah.
I've just bought your book and I'm looking forward to it. I wanted to ask you about Myth 43, which was I'll be very brief. very brief. I realized you had to compress this. You say
don't blame Arafat.
Yes,
that's Myth 43.
Yeah. Okay. For what? So I'm interested in what you think he should be blamed for. And the final sentence in that myth would be that Arafat increasingly pushed his own population into the Islamist militants such as Islamic Jihad and Hamas. Does that not belittle the intelligence of the Palestinians and overestimate the importance of the situational factors in Palestine? And but my second question was, you said it's important to detribalize the conflict between Israel and Palestine. At the same time, I think I'm sure you argue it's important not to sort of split the difference somehow. I mean, in the conflicting view, some are more right and some are less right. Sorry, just to get to my point here. Do you not think that essentially the myths are more on one side than the other? I mean, for me, I'd say most Israelis have a more of a sort of distorted account of the history than the Palestinian side.
Okay. I think we got the message. Take those three, yeah.
Well, let me answer the question on Arab-Israeli this way. First of all, I did not say we should detribalize the Arab-Israeli question. I see we detribalize a whole range of issues. I don't believe in making the Arab-Israeli question somehow different from, obviously it's specific, as is the Irish question or the Basque question or whatever, but it is part of a broader set of five or six major conflicts in the region. And indeed, it's comparable to the Irish problems, the Bosnian problems, and so on. So I think the focus on the Arab-Israeli question alone distorts the study of the Middle East analytically and morally. And I did not specifically single it out as the one to detribalize. I think Sunni Shia, Northern and Southern Sudan, Yemeni, Saudi, and so forth, all require detribalization in the sense that the debate should not, and I'm going to talk about this tomorrow, should not be set by nationalists or ethnic diasporas or whatever, but should be set by ourselves as social scientists. That's number one. I supported the two-state solution from the 67 war when I became interested in the Palestine question. I did not get invested in the Middle East originally through the Palestine question. I got interested originally through Iran and the Gulf, thank God, as far as I'm concerned, because it gave me a different perspective, which I've sought to maintain. And I am of the view, insofar as one can talk in history in any place, in Ireland or Western Sahara or Colombia or wherever it may be, of missed opportunities, I think there were three missed opportunities. I think there was a missed opportunity after 67. I think there was a missed opportunity after the 73 war. And there was a missed opportunity after Oslo, and I was and remain a staunch supporter of the Oslo Agreement, imperfect as it was, in the face of all the nonsense and the criticism which is made of it from both sides. I'm probably the only person who is, but I'm sticking to my guns on that. Negotiated, may I say, by two Norwegian diplomats who were graduates of the London School of Economics. But I think that after 2000, after the end of the Barak government, the failure not just of Camp David in the summer, but of the very belated and rushed negotiations which followed later up to Taba, with the bitterness generated in both Israeli and Palestinian population by the last 3 or 4 years, and with the failure of the international community to make a significant impact on either side, I have come to the reluctant conclusion that the time for a peaceful negotiation settlement has already passed. While there is a truce at the moment, this will not last, and that we are in for much more trouble and time in the future. I don't say this with any pleasure. It fills me with deep unease. I've lectured both at Beer Zeit and at Tel Aviv University, and I'm proud to do so and would do so again. And I would like to think that there is a compromise, but I think those who promote compromise on both sides are even more in a minority than they ever were. It's up to those of you from those countries to contradict me, and I hope you do, and I hope I'm wrong. But I think that is the case. However, I do not think the conflict is primarily about religion. Zionism was a secular ideology. Palestinian nationalism was not particularly religious when I got to know it. Religion is used by both sides, but even the conflict over Jerusalem, let's face it, the sacralization or the religiousization, or even say, of the Jerusalem issue is a matter of the last 2 decades. I happen to be an old-fashioned rationalist. I don't think there is such a thing as holy land, or holy tax, or holy anything. But obviously a lot of other people disagree. I would have to say, in all truth, that the first time in my knowledge that all the religious authorities of Jerusalem got together in common cause recently was to oppose a gay rights march. So that's how holy they are. And I think that we should be skeptical about claiming that it's fundamentally about religion. Moreover, were we to return to more optimistic mode and the demystification of false traditions, then you can use religion for peaceful purposes if you want to. There are plenty of passages in the Islamic tradition which call for bloodthirsty extermination of Jews and kuffar and the rest of it, but there are also lots of others which allow you to make compromises. And on the Jewish side, much is made that a Jewish state cannot give away Jewish land. But in the Book of Kings, King Solomon, in gratitude to King Hiram of Tyre, who gave him cedar wood to build the temple, gave him 20 villages in Galilee. Now, 20 villages in Galilee is as about Eretz Israel Jewish land as you could possibly want, a lot more than Gaza. So if you want, and that's the key point for modernist reasons, to give away Jewish land in compromise with your neighbors, King Solomon did it, why can't you? Well, the reason you can't is modern nationalist politics, it ain't religion. On quickly on the, where are we? Arafat. I met him twice. I followed his career, and I stick by my critique of him there. He also allowed more than one of my friends to be murdered without doing anything about it, Palestinian and non-Palestinian. If the logic of my missed opportunities argument holds, not he alone, I hasten to add, Israelis more than played their part, but he also mishandled this issue very badly. I think in particular the Second Intifada was a disaster for the Palestinian people, and the consequence is the one I identify here in Myth 43, which is, and this is what Abu Mazen, who I also know, must be having sleepless nights about. If they have open legislative elections, Hamas and Jihad are going to, if not sweep the board, then have a very strong role. And that is a consequence of allowing this crazy intifada and all the rest of it to go ahead. The fires are burning on both sides. Most young Israelis, according to the polls, don't believe in democracy anymore. Sharon is running around in circles. I think this truce we got at the moment is temporary, and I hope I'm wrong.
We've got time for a couple more questions, so there you go.
Hello.
Sorry,
Professor Halliday.
Could we have the question here first and then your question? We'll do both of them, don't worry.
Okay, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, first question, what do you think the future holds for Syria? And secondly, how far do you see Hezbollah be emerging as a more independent entity in that particular area?
Okay, thanks. Could you use the microphone, please?
I think before...
Sorry, could you use the microphone?
Before Saddam invaded Kuwait, I believe that the American ambassador in Baghdad, I think her name was Mrs. Green or something.
Gillespie. April Gillespie.
Yes. She actually is recorded to have said that if Saddam goes to Kuwait, since it is an inter-Arab conflict with regarding the 17th state that Saddam claimed Kuwait to be, the Americans would ignore the whole thing. I would like to ask Professor Halliday if he thinks this was in fact the ruse to entrap Saddam or not, despite the fact that what he said, the Iraqis basically supported Saddam, of course, in his invasion. Probably that is true, but I think he was entrapped. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Let's just take those two and finish there, yeah?
Okay, let me deal with the last one. Thank you, Dr. Sabetian. You've allowed me to read from Myth 45, which is that the U.S., through its ambassador in Baghdad, April Gillespie, encouraged Saddam to invade Kuwait in August 1990. I won't read the whole thing. I say, we don't have the whole text, but the Iraqis have released a text which no one has challenged, although it looks like a retranslation. In this transcript, Glaspie is quoted as saying, I have a direct instruction from the president to seek better relations with Iraq. She does not endorse an Iraqi occupation of Kuwait, but only puts on record what is general American policy and would normally be that of any sovereign state, namely that it doesn't get involved in border disputes between two neighbors. We have no opinion on the Arab-Israeli conflict, like your border dispute with Kuwait, and so on. In other words, this was not a green light. She really said something which any sensible person would have known was an American way of saying, solve your problem. But in no way did she encourage, and this is on the evidence of the documents which the Iraqis have released, did she encourage the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, which Saddam wanted to do for quite other reasons. A very interesting academic debate as to why he did invade Kuwait. There are many different reasons. I, with my bias towards Professors Light, Hill, Coker, and others, favor a foreign policy analysis explanation, which was that Iraq was internally in a terrible crisis after failing to defeat Iran in the 8 years of war up to 1988, and he had to do something to distract attention from the internal tensions. That's my gut feeling, but it's only a gut feeling, plus one or two conversations with a couple of Saddam's advisors with whom I was at university many years ago. On Syria, nobody knows. Clearly, the president has taken fright in withdrawing from Lebanon, but the Syrians have one big card up their sleeve, which is to say we've left Lebanon, and now the poor little Lebanese don't know how to solve their problems, and they're going to go back to fighting each other. And it wouldn't take much for the Syrians to promote that or to allow it to happen. I don't think the Syrians know what to do in Lebanon. I don't think the Americans know, and I don't think the Israelis know either. No one knows what to do, and no one knows what's going to happen, although everybody, curiously, has a shared hope that it will stabilize and that there won't be a recrudescence of fighting. And I myself am more, not that I'm a Lebanon expert, really that Kirsten Schultz and others have got her in the De La Cura, my instinct is they may find a new political compromise. On Hezbollah, I had a curious experience last year of going to Beirut and of being invited to visit their headquarters in the south of Beirut because the deputy head of Hezbollah, Sheikh Naim Qasim, liked something I'd written, which was in particular my critique of the clash of civilizations. And the reason for that, very simply, is that Samuel Huntington and his theories are very popular among Sunnis, bin Laden, and Salafis, and Sunni Muslim brothers and people in Lebanon and elsewhere. So the Shiites, who are the people supporting Hezbollah, are against the theory of the clash of civilizations. So they're talking about pluralism and all the rest of it. He wanted me to introduce his book, but I said I didn't think this would go down very well with the RAE, so I declined to introduce his book, but we had a long discussion. However, I talked to him, and I also spent a day with one of their military commanders in the south of Lebanon, and he took me to the Israeli frontier, which is about as far away as the back of this room, or a little bit further, near the town of Metula, which I could see very clearly. I was struck by the determination which he expressed that they would pursue the struggle against Israel into the distant future. What he said to me was very simple. He said, it took us 22 years to get them out of here, and it may take us 40 years to get them out of there, but we're going to do it. And he said what Sharon said. He said, we have people in the West Bank, we have people in Gaza, and we're going to continue supporting Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad, and Hamas for as long as it takes. In the end, he may be overruled, because from what we know, the military inside Hezbollah are not as strong as the political people. Hezbollah is running elections, social services becoming a normal party. But on the other hand, Hezbollah's legitimacy in Lebanon beyond its core Shiite community rests on being the force which fights Israelis and defends the sovereignty of the Arabs and so forth. So I think it's not quite as settled as it may be, but I think for the moment they want to pacify things in Lebanon and increase their power. A bit like, what's it called? Sinn Féin, isn't it, over there in Ireland, also smiling and standing for elections, but as they say, are keeping their toolkit in the garage. And I don't think that Hezbollah has been simply tamed, and we'll just have to wait and see.
Fred is coming back tomorrow evening to speak again on the subject on solidarity, and the Middle East, so I think we'll let him get away now, but I'd like to express the our thanks for his talk this evening and for answering the questions. Thanks very much. will be a reception. There will be a reception upstairs, which many of you will know about.